violent protests and clashes with police.
A community racked by fear and unrest.
Demonstrators.
It's just complete lawlessness in the street.
A state of emergency.
Demonstrations.
Peaceful protests and violent riots.
For more than a week, we've been hearing news of protests, riots, unrest, and conflict in Ferguson, Missouri. When we discussed responses to police shootings on this show last week, something that came up was the history of racially charged conflict in St. Louis specifically, and in the Midwest more generally. We decided to follow up by looking more deeply into that history. What can the experiences of those who lived through the most tumultuous days of the civil rights era tell us about our present-day unrest? That's the big question on today's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and with me by phone is Reverend Nelson Fuzzy Thompson. He's been a civil rights leader in Kansas City for decades, and he's currently president of the local chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Hi, Reverend.
How are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
When you read the headlines and see images coming out of Ferguson, do you find yourself thinking back to Kansas City in April of 1968?
I surely do. I surely do. I was in college during the time. I was finishing up my senior year in college, and I remember coming home from college for the weekend. I think it was on a Thursday evening, and getting off there, getting off of I-70 down at Myrtle at the bottom of the hill, coming up the hill to 31st Street. And when I got to 31st Street, the street was blocked off by a tank.
Wow.
Of course, I had never seen a tank in, you know, live tank.
Yeah, and that's quite a welcome home.
I've seen them on television, but never in real. You know, and certainly not on the streets that I travel back and forth home. And then, of course, I noticed that the air smelled like gunpowder, and there were tanks, other tanks going up and down 31st Street.
Can you tell us the story of what had happened? What happened in Kansas City in April of 1968, as you remember it?
Well, Dr. King was assassinated on April 4th, and shortly thereafter, riots broke out in a lot of cities around the country, as for various reasons, people wanted to have services to recognize King. I think in Kansas City, they wanted to have school dismissed. There was a lot of reaction from the black community, especially, and from what I would call the underclass, in response to the assassination of King, wanting some retribution for that or something done about that, and it caused riots to break out all over Detroit, Los Angeles, Kansas City. I'm not sure about St. Louis, but I know, you know, in a number of major cities all over the country, riots broke out.
Do you know how the riots here turned violent? I read that Mayor Ilas Davis came out and was actually joining with the protesters sitting on the lawn of City Hall on the first day of protests when people were calling for a day of commemoration for King's funeral. Do you know how that turned into the violent escalation where you're coming home and finding a tank blocking the street?
No, I don't, but I know that I think Kelly, Chief Kelly, was the police chief during the time. And I think Alvin Brooks was on the police department. He was a policeman.
And we've contacted him, so hopefully he'll be calling in at some point. We do hope that. Anyway, go on.
But I think that basically, people, you know, again, the underclass, people want to express themselves. People want to express their anger and disgust. And so the police step up to try to keep that in control. And then you get what you've gotten in St. Louis this past week. You get a reaction, one to the other, which oftentimes ends up in riots.
Well, I've been listening back to some radio interviews conducted at the time of Kansas City's riots in 1968, conducted by none other than the late Walt Bodine on the third night of the riots. And it sounded like things had started to cool down that night, but the curfew was still in progress. Things were still incredibly tense. And I'd like to play a clip of Walt talking to the Jackson County Sheriff at the end of a long conversation about the need for more police officers.
You know, you're in this very deeply, and yet at this moment you're able to back off a little bit and look at it. For the ultimate solution, it takes more. Yes, you restore order by force, and you can keep a good measure of it by a lot of force. But ultimately, it's going to call for more than this, and ultimately it's going to call for a lot of understanding and a lot of conversation and a great deal of exchange of views that means more than what's taken place in the past. Have you any notions of what really in the long haul is going to lower the pressure in this great boiler that's blown up?
Well, I think the first thing that we're going to have to take these Typhoid Marys off the street. Now, these people, as I say, are these socially unmanageable.
So hearing,
on the streets down
hearing
there,
Walt's plea for conversation and for people to talk to each other and try to understand each other is so heart-wrenching because 46 years later, if my math is correct, these are still the pleas we're hearing for conversation, for understanding. Does it feel that way to you, Reverend?
Oh, absolutely. And because you generally have large groups of people on either side of the issue who are not talking and who are responding to each other through anger and frustration. And what erupts from that is violence. And, of course, some people are taking advantage of it for the wrong reason. That's why you get the looting and the destruction and that kind of behavior. But it is only going to be worked out when there's conversation, when there's a sense of understanding and appreciation for the conditions and under which people are living. You know, you got a lot of young men who are unemployed, who are not in school, who are frustrated with their lives and their future. And so they lash out.
Well, Reverend, what do you think finally caused order and calm to reemerge in 1968?
Well, it simmers down after a while, especially when you have, you know, the National Guard and state police, coupled with local police, federal intervention in many ways, and when people feel like they're beginning to be heard, and there is a sense in which there's negotiation, there's real talk, there's real understanding, or at least we try to understand and appreciate the kind of conditions that the people are living under, you know, programs to provide jobs and to provide opportunities for people to improve their condition, improve their housing.
Do you think that the riots of 1968 in Kansas City changed anything? That is to say, is there like a Kansas City before April of 1968 and a Kansas City after April of 1968?
Oh, yeah, it changed things. It definitely changed things. It's unfortunate that it has to come to that before it changes. But, yeah, it changes things, and people realize that you've got everybody has to be given an opportunity.
If you could speak directly to the people of Ferguson today, what would you tell them?
The violence will not solve the problem. Violence only makes the problem worse. We need to sit down and try to hear each other and have a sense of peace and harmony and appreciation for the conditions that exist. Do what we can to improve the conditions for everybody.
Do you have a suggestion for how people can be heard in a way that maybe isn't through the means that they're already attempting? Is there another way to be heard?
Well, I noticed that most of the, a lot of the meetings are being held in churches. A lot of the press conferences are being held in churches. This is a real important role that the church can play in the community, because there are a number of churches in the community, generally in the heart of the community, where these riots are occurring. Let these churches step forward, pastors, and take a leadership role in bringing people together of all races, of all persuasions, of all sexes, and let them begin to sit down and look at what are the solutions to these problems that cause people to be frustrated and angry.
Thank you so much, Reverend Nelson Fuzzy Thompson, for speaking with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
We're joined now by people who have studied the history of racial tensions and uprisings in Midwestern towns and cities. With us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence is Clarence Lang, a professor in KU's Department of African and African American Studies. Hi, Professor Lang.
Good morning.
And by phone from Columbia, Missouri, we've got Rusty Monholland, author of the book This Is America, the 60s in Lawrence, Kansas. He now works for the Missouri Department of Higher Education. Hi, Rusty.
Good morning.
So, Professor Lang, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about the history of racial tensions in St. Louis.
That's a big question. There's so many places to start this conversation, but one place is to, I think, to talk about how, the St. Louis metropolitan area has been a pioneer in forms of racial apartheid in housing. So whether we're talking about housing segregation passed in 1916, the creation of restrictive covenants in the 1920s, zoning laws after World War II, the creation of private gated streets, so on and so forth. St. Louis is kind of been notorious in developing these forms of segregation of place. And I think that, as much as anything, is part of the raw material, if you will, of the problems that we're seeing and the misunderstandings, if we want to use that word, the conflicts, the inequalities. So even after Shelley versus Kramer, important Supreme Court ruling in 1948, ruling that restrictive housing covenants were unenforceable in court, even after Jones versus Mayer, another Supreme Court ruling in 1968, defending fair housing, we still see these continuing forms of segregation and housing, and not just simply segregation, but also the kinds of concentrated poverty, commercial abandonment, political isolation that comes along with this kind of segregation of space. So it's not just simply people living separately, but also living at the same time unequally.
Well, Professor Lang, I've read about a handful, actually, of different uprisings in St. Louis, one in 1917, one in 1949. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of uprising in St. Louis around these issues?
Well, the history that you referred to, I think, in some ways is a there are a couple of, if we want to talk about riots, I mean that there are different sort of models of that. So, 1917, if I think I know what you're talking about, is the race riot in East St. Louis, Illinois, which is actually across the river and across the river from Missouri, but is part of the, if you will, the St. Louis metro area. And that was actually a case of white civilians, workers, and state guards essentially rampaging on the black community there in response to tensions around black migration to the area, conflict around employment. 1949, I believe you're referring to the fairgrounds park.
Yes, with the swimming pool.
That's right. Where you had white civilians reacting violently to attempts on the part of African Americans and allies of goodwill to desegregate that swimming facility. And that occurred in 1949, and I believe there was another another conflict around that in 1950. So that's one particular kind of model there, and I think I think you're right to raise that, because if we want to talk about rioting, what have you, that has to be understood as part of that longer history as well. Riots, if we want to use that, sure.
One thing that interested me about the 1949 riot, if I understand the sequence of events correctly, there was an order for the swimming pool to be desegregated, for anyone of any race to be able to swim in this pool. On the first day that that was possible, there was maybe about 30 or so black people who showed up to swim and about 200 white people who showed up to swim. Everything's kind of uneasily okay for a while until a bunch of people with baseball bats and clubs and things arrive, at which point one black person pulls out a knife, and that's when everything erupted. But it's kind of an interesting thing that for a while there was this uneasy calm, and then, you know, that things just escalate quickly like that.
St. Louis, I think, is in Missouri more generally is an interesting place, because it's geographically and in some ways politically, certainly demographically, was the Midwest, economically in some ways. But also there's a long, if you will, kind of Southern heritage as well. I mean, Missouri was a slave state, and so it carries the baggage of that history as well. And so St. Louis is a case, not to overgeneralize, but, I mean, it becomes a space where you have the convergence, the collisions of these different kinds of historical and cultural traditions. And so, yes, I mean, there was legally sanctioned segregation in St. Louis, but it occurred in these very uneven kinds of ways. So by state constitution, there were bans against interracial marriage, for example, or school integration, for example. But there was this whole kind of gray area, which existed in some other Southern communities as well, you know. But there was this whole gray area where things were not quite certain in terms of where the color line was. And so, yes, I mean, the response wasn't immediate, but when that response occurred and as it snowballed, I mean, it became quite ferocious.
And Rusty Mulholland, what about Lawrence, Kansas? You begin your book writing about a period of unrest in Lawrence precipitated by a police shooting of a young black man, and this is in 1970.
Yeah, in July of 1970, a 19-year-old African-American man named Rick Tiger Dowdell was shot by a Lawrence police officer. Now, this had been preceded by, in April, a period of tension and unrest. In fact, Lawrence had been placed under a curfew in the aftermath of an arson, which burned the KU Memorial Union. There had been demonstrations, you know, against the Vietnam War, an increased presence throughout the community of what we would commonly refer to as the counterculture, young people primarily who were, you know, either dissatisfied or seeking another way of living within the United States and pursuing their sense of values in a slightly different way. There had been a walkout by black students at the high school in April of that year, you know, protesting the lack of a curriculum that, you know, reflected anything, any part of their heritage, the lack of...
And had those been peaceful protests?
Well, they had been confrontational, and I think there was a great deal of tension. There wasn't, I wouldn't call them violent in that there wasn't bombing or gunshots or any death or injury, but there was this tension that permeated the situation. So I think that was the potential for something to really explode and send the tense situation kind of over the top was always there.
And that did set the stage for July 1970.
Yeah, and I think that precipitating incident was the death of Rick Dowdell. In the aftermath of his death, there Lawrence again was placed under an emergency, put in under an emergency situation. National Guard, the Kansas Highway Patrol had been sent to the area to help restore calm and relieve the Lawrence police of some of their duties. A few days after Dowdell was killed, another young man, Nick Rice from Kansas City, who by all accounts was just visiting the area. I believe he had come to campus to pay a library fine, was shot and killed when Lawrence police fired into a crowd seeking to disperse them.
So just caught in the crossfire.
In many ways, he certainly wasn't protesting or hadn't been any an active participant in any of the incidents that came as a result of Rick Dowdell's death.
Professor Lang, when people think of the history of the Midwest, this is not usually what they think of. Is there sort of a lack of awareness of these things, or is that just a perception on my part?
I think we can document the fact that, you're talking about in terms of urban disturbances occurring in the Midwest.
Yeah.
I mean, there were many of them that occurred. Certainly, if we're making the parallels to the 1960s, the Midwest was rife with these. So whether we're talking about Chicago or Detroit and even smaller communities, mid-sized communities, there were actually disturbances in St. Louis. In the 1960s, throughout that period, they weren't major disturbances, but they did occur. Local authorities were more effective in blacking them out, if you will, in the media. And in St. Louis, there was a tradition of interracial civility, and so people were part of networks that allowed them to very quickly gain control, if you will, of the situation. But I mean, there are folks who are doing work who will tell you that, in fact, if we think about where most of these disturbances occurred in the 1960s, they were in the Midwest in cities large, small, and medium.
Why do you think that is? What do you think it was about the culture of the Midwest at that time that made it sort of a petri dish for unrest?
Well, I think part of what we're seeing here, and I think part of what we saw then, is that these conflicts were tied to these longstanding grievances around things such as employment, housing, and schools, meaningful opportunity and mobility. And certainly in places like Detroit, St. Louis, certainly in other places, industrial Midwest, the 50s and the 60s, I mean, that was a period when a lot of commerce, a lot of industry was either in decline or was leaving or in crisis. And so I think in some ways you had there were a lot of grievances around issues such as economic opportunity that people saw retreating, even though they were the children of people who had migrated for opportunity in industry and what have you. And what occurs is that an act of police violence or excessive force, that these things, that becomes a catalyst to, and I'm going to mix metaphors, right, breaking the dam of all of these grievances that have been piling up for some time. And so if we think about the economy of the urban Midwest, not to be economically determinist or, you know, just to leave it there. But if we think about in some ways the economic landscape, that's part of the matrix here.
Well, Professor Lang, I want to run a quote from an article in The Atlantic by you. This is an article about the St. Louis race riots of 1949, and it came out very recently, just in the last week. Landon Jones, the author of that article, says, "Then and now, the root cause of violence was segregation."
I mean, there are always multiple causes. So the root cause, I mean, we could probably go back and forth. Certainly, that's a big part of it. I mean, as I was saying a moment ago, that is, it's that people are deprived. People are they're seeing declining meaningful opportunity, but they're also spatially isolated.
Well, when we come back from break, we're going to get you in on this conversation. We'll want to know, were you a witness to the Kansas City, St. Louis, or Lawrence riots of the 1960s and 70s? What do you think we should have learned from those incidents, and do you see echoes of those events in Ferguson today? Call us at 816-235-2888 to share your insights. Central Standard will be right back.
The situation in Kansas City tonight, a situation that was greatly calmed in comparison with the violence that racked the city's east side just 24 hours ago. Reporting by direct report from the police command headquarters, WHB Newsman Leif Williams.
Kansas City police and beefed up patrols of National Guardsmen and state troopers kept the lid on Kansas City last night. It was a different atmosphere at police headquarters and on city streets, virtually deserted after an area-wide curfew was placed into effect at 7 o'clock. Officers have been less grim as they've been filing in and out of the central command post here, the office of Chief Clarence Kelly. From this vantage point, direction has gone to the field command headquarters at the World War II building at Linwood and Paseo. That area came under sniper fire tonight, but it was quickly alleviated. Actually, it's been almost a complete reversal with the way things were going 24 hours earlier. Wednesday night, snipers were pinning firemen and policemen down, and the east central part of the city was aflame with damaging fires. The fire loss that's been pegged at more than $500,000. There were fires tonight, about 13 of them, but they were not as serious tonight by far as they were last night. Two men accused of snipers were booked, and one other gun toter was arrested. White men nabbed in separate incidents shortly before 11 o'clock. Charged with carrying concealed weapons, possession of marijuana, and felonious assault were 24-year-old Wesley Cox and 21-year-old Leo Constanza, both of Kansas City. Also arrested on a charge of carrying a concealed weapon, 41-year-old Richard Bourjane. Chief Kelly, who emerged from his office to talk with newsmen, said the arrests were significant. And in response to questions, he added, some information is being developed that indicated there might be some agitators from out of the city who had been helping fan the flames of the disorder.
You've been listening to news reports from 1968 in Kansas City. That was from the end of a program called Night Beat, and that was 3 days into the riots of 1968. We are looking back at the history of racially charged protesting, rioting, and we want to talk about that terminology a little bit, too, to help us get a sense of context for what's happening in Ferguson right now. And we'll want to hear from you at 816-235-2888 if you have memories and insights to share with us from those days. We've got Rusty Monholland on the line. He's the author of This is America, the 60s in Lawrence, Kansas. We're also talking with Clarence Lang, who's a professor of African and African-American studies at KU in Lawrence. Welcome back, gentlemen. And Professor Lang, you were just talking about that the root causes of violence in these situations are myriad, that you can't really put it on just one thing. Listening back to that footage from 1968, does anything strike you, I guess?
Well, I mean, I think on the one hand, there's a way in which you could think that you're hearing newscasts from today, right? And so I think that there are very obvious and easy ways that we can make references to that particular past. in the 1960s. And there's a lot of good reason for that. I mean, I think a lot of things that were discussed in the Kerner Commission report in 1968 about the causes of such disturbances are still pertinent today.
Could you share those with us?
Sure. Oh, sure. I mean, there were grievances about the lack of responsiveness from City Hall, lack of access to public amenities, these ongoing issues around under or unemployment, issues around housing, issues around schools, which has emerged as an issue on the margins of these protests in Ferguson, and overall sense of mobility and opportunity. That will sort of be my mantra. And that's what the Kerner Commission report found as the root, sort of undergirding these disturbances, with police violence and active police violence. That's being an ongoing problem, but a particular event, in a sense, lighting the match, right, setting the whole thing ablaze. So there's a lot that's pertinent, I think, from that period to now. I guess I'm sort of careful, you know, as someone who sort of thinks about or approaches history from the standpoint of what remains continuous, but also what changes. I mean, I think we also have to understand that there's a very contemporary context in addition to these longstanding issues of housing discrimination and employment discrimination.
Yes, thank you, because we don't want to make too easy of a comparison and be sort of false in that.
Well, I mean, I think that they're accurate. I mean, I think that these are very, I think, sort of reasonable comparisons. But I mean, we have the issue of gathering steam in the 1990s, the war on drugs, which led to 2.3 million people incarcerated, the majority of whom were black and brown, and the consequences of that being this kind of general or new forms of criminalization of black and brown bodies and communities, weakening of Fourth Amendment protections and other kinds of civil liberties, and the militarization of local police force. I'm very heartened that people have sort of rediscovered that issue. But these conversations have been ongoing among scholars and others and activists since the 1990s, particularly in working class and poor communities and working class and poor communities of color, where people were seeing this phenomenon. Have watched this phenomenon develop over a long haul. And certainly, I mean, part of the issue in Ferguson and Missouri, and I dare say around the nation, I mean, sort of tied to what I'm talking about, is this issue of racial profiling. And people talk about sort of the disturbances or the rioting, that's occurring in the streets.
How do you choose which word you use, by the way?
Well, for me, whether one uses rebellion or uprising or riot, I mean, to me, that's less important than that we understand. However, whatever term we use, it's a political phenomenon, and we should interpret and understand and assess it on that basis. I think there's a very easy way in which we sort of talk about this as quote unquote crime. And I'm not saying that that's inaccurate, but I'm saying that this is also sort of, these are also, however we think about them, whether we, however we think about them, that these are political acts. They are political phenomenon. And so if we are to address them, then we have to understand and address them on those terms. Because I would say, having lived in a couple of communities, having grown up in a black urban community, that there's been low intensity warfare between members of these communities and police for some time. And what's occurring in Ferguson is that simply that ongoing low-intensity warfare is just out and open in a way that we don't see every day. We have to understand it, I think, in that context.
I want to get a caller in on this idea of low-intensity warfare between the community and police over a long period of time. We've got a call from Alvin Brooks, and he is with the Ad Hoc Group. Hi, Alvin Brooks. How are you?
Good morning to everyone. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Yeah, and you were a police officer in 68, right?
No, I was not a police officer.
Oh, okay.
In 68. I ended my career in 64, but I was there when the young people were walking out of the various schools, and I was there when the mayor met them at 17 Terrace and Vine here in Kansas, Missouri, and then also marched with them along with a couple of Chiefs players, Curtis McQuinn and Otis Taylor, and my homeboy, I should say, Reverend Kenneth Ray, who's a minister. And we were there on the steps of City Hall when all of this broke out. And let me just hasten to say very quickly, and then I'll take your questions. But It was not the police, the National Guard, and the state troopers that quelled the riot in Kansas City. It was the people in the community. And I'm afraid that that's what's going to have to take place in Ferguson and any other community. Police in those days, and somewhat today, and you saw that the first couple of days there in Ferguson, they escalate things. I mean, they increase the potential. But there are also always those who are opportunists, regardless of the race, ethnicity, and where it occurs. I can recall when there was a tornado in Kansas City, in South Kansas City. Some police officers that lived in the Ruskin area were stealing from their neighbors because of that. So I think the opportunity presents itself, and as human beings, sometimes those opportunities make criminals out of those who normally would not do anything.
When you say that that it was the community that quelled the violence ultimately, how was that achieved? Can you sort of unpack
Because we took to the streets. We took to the streets 24 hours, and we disputed a lot of what was reported by the media, particularly the electronic media, those who were riding around in cars. And in one station in particular, and I call a name, I was behind the car that had the call letters and everything on it, and at 34th and Prospect, I lived at 3336 Agnes, just three blocks away, and he reported that there was gunfire and from the apartment building at 34th and Prospect, and he told a lie. It wasn't true, and I called into the station. They relieved the person of his responsibility. But I'm thinking these kinds of things, I think, that really moves a community from where it should be to where today. But it didn't just start with the Michael Brown. It festered. I have before me here two documents. One, the Mayor's Commission on Civil Disorder, August of 15, 1968. And this, what they did, this is the final report. I also have before me a three-year later report, of which then I became Director of Human Relations. There was no Department of Human Relations prior to my being appointed. I was appointed 27th of May, 1968. And three, we did an update of the report that was written in 68. We did this in 71, three-year report, The Quality of Urban Life. And we dealt with those issues that came out of the original report in September of 1968. Very little change. And I think that when you've got a community where, and as I was rereading this report, it shows how the police were gearing up for violence, gearing up for riot gear and training. What they never did, was really meeting with the black community and seeing what those issues were. And I remember the night, Monday night, the 8th of April, I was with the school district. I was in the urban department of urban education, and a meeting. I just returned from Memphis, where Mrs. King was speaking, and came back. My wife said, "There's a meeting at the school board this evening, and Dr. Wheeler, Robert R. Wheeler, was director of urban education, superintendent of urban education. There were three black men, myself, Dr. Robert Wheeler, and Dr. Alita Campbell, and there were seven or eight white directors and assistant superintendents. Hazard was out of town, and he was on the phone. Jim Hazard was the superintendent. We urged them not to open the schools that Tuesday morning on the 9th. They overruled us, and that's why we had the riot, because those kids from those various schools, where Kansas was out, and the superintendent Tucker, as well as the police and the mayor, said close the schools so that the kids can, if they want to, have memorial services. They didn't do that here. And so that's why they're responsible for those kids coming together in several hundred of them, and that's why we had the riot in 1968 in Kansas City. But the cause, the real cause, was the relationship between the community and the educational system and the police department and city government.
All right, Al Brooks, I'd love for you to stick with us for a minute because I want to bring Rusty Mulholland on this to get some comparison with what was going on in Lawrence at the time. Rusty, you were telling us earlier about the riots that were going on that had, you know, people died. It was a really intense scene in Lawrence in 1970. How did that end up? What was sort of, how did it calm down and what was the outcome of it?
Just to be clear, I wouldn't characterize what happened in Lawrence in 1970 as a riot. Certainly, the death of Rick Dowdell and Nick Rice were tragic and created the potential for a riot. It could have been a lot more deaths and injuries and property damage.
Well, maybe go back then and describe the scene as you understand it. How would you describe those couple of weeks in Lawrence? What were some of the things that characterized it?
Well, I think it was, in many ways, Lawrence was, ready to explode. But I think this goes to your question and what kind of where you were headed is that the Kansas Highway Patrol in particular came to Lawrence in the summer of 1970 and began policing in a much different way from which the Lawrence Police Department had been doing. We talked about they didn't use riot gear. They met with and talked to, various groups that felt wronged or had grievances or, saw what had happened over the last several days as, a lack of justice or didn't square with their vision of what life in the United States should be. So I think it was, perhaps the more the different approach taken by the Highway Patrol. But I think both Reverend Nelson and Mr. Brooks have both pointed out, I think it was also the work of the people themselves within the community. Lawrence, the business community, civic leaders, just people from a wide spectrum across the community, really sought out answers to this situation and, really wanted to try to understand what was going on and why this situation had presented itself. By the end of the year, there had been some task force formed and some changes had been made, somewhat reluctantly within the police department, that recommended different approaches to policing and community policing.
You're listening.
So I think I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to let our listeners know that they are listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to a conversation about the history of racially charged conflict in the Midwest in cities like Kansas City, Lawrence, and, yes, St. Louis. We've got a call from Bill who wants to weigh in. We have invited our listeners to share their stories and memories at 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Glad you to answer your call. I'm a United Methodist pastor, and several years ago, about 12 years ago, I was invited by the gentleman himself to do his funeral. He was a civil rights leader back during this time when they talked about desegregation in Webster Groves, Missouri. Now, the church I serve was a very affluent, mostly white church, and I told the gentleman I'd be glad to, and he was dying of cancer. And during this time, I had found out stories, and he had led the desegregation of the Webster Groves pool, and they decided, rather than have mixed bathing, as I remember the story, they would have one day of whites, and then the next day the blacks would have the pool. And after the day for the African-Americans, they drained the pool and refilled it. And
oh, my
gosh. There
was
such an uproar that they just closed the pool completely. And that's the story that amazed me in this neighborhood. But as I then was called on to do a funeral for another African-American person, and in this all-white congregation, they became very uncomfortable with their pastor doing these funerals. Nothing was said overtly, but the kind of little racist comments that were said was just unbelievable.
And this was just 12 years ago?
This is just 12 years ago. He was in his 80s, and it was quite the church is a large church. There were probably 500 people there. 90% of the people were African Americans. There was suspicion. Well, that may be the wrong word, but I felt that there was people wanted to know what was happening. And at first they were proud, but then they got to worrying about these strangers in their kitchen. And racism was always underneath the surface.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing that, Bill. And I want to go to another caller who also has a memory to share, and then we'll get some response from our guests to these things. We've got Chester in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Chester.
How are you this morning?
Good. How are you? Please go on.
Yeah, I live in Kansas City, Kansas, and oftentimes Kansas City, Kansas is forgotten or overlooked. I would like to point out that there was a, quote, riot. It was a mini riot in Kansas City, Kansas, the year before the Watts riot. And that was due to a policeman turning dogs loose on some people on North 5th Street. And that precipitated a lot of controversy over here. Fortunately, at that time, there were a number of persons from the majority community or from the white community, many of them who were professors at Central Baptist Seminary, who joined in and helped diffuse the situation, because we had already protested the appointment of a police chief. And these were very controversial times, and he had ordered the dogs, and he had been a retired FBI agent from Mississippi. The other thing, in 1968, and Alvin, if you're still listening, hello, Alvin, because we both were members of CORE, and so Alvin used to come over and help us because Alvin was one of the people who would come over and help, because there were not a lot of people in Kansas City, Kansas, who would join in the struggle. But in 1968, the person really, in many of our opinions, who was responsible for not having a problem over here, and I shouldn't say not having a problem, but not having rights, was the police chief, Boston Daniels, who was the first and only black police chief in Kansas City, Kansas. And Joe McDowell had the courage to appoint him back during that time, and most people, young and old, respected him.
Well, you know, we do still have Alvin Brooks on the line. Maybe we can let him respond to that. What do you think, Chester?
That's excellent.
Okay, let's get Alvin Brooks's response. Hi.
I hope this is my friend Chester Owens.
Please go on.
Okay, well, anyway, I think, you know, I was, what's being said is very true. And let me just read one sentence, which is a quote that when I testified before this commission, and this is my quote, I said to the commission, a civil disorder will not occur except where there is a long history of social tensions which have been festered over time and which allow the final spark to grow into a riot. That's one of the keys. Whether it's Ferguson, whether it's Kansas City, Kansas, whether it's Kansas City, Missouri, wherever it is, it's long-standing social issues that the majority of society, those in control, did not address.
In what year was that your testimony? What year was that?
1960. This was in the final report that came out here in Kansas City, August 15th, 1968. Four months after the civil disorder.
Is it disheartening for you that we're having this such a similar conversation so many years later?
Well, it is, and I'm sure if Chester's still on it, and the same thing is that we tend not to deal with these issues until we have riots, until we have upheavals, until we have confrontation. And the whole issue of race in America is an ongoing process that ought to be an ongoing process. I think the president has addressed this issue. I think that others are addressing this issue, and locally we're addressing this issue. But for some reason, unless you have this kind of upheaval, you don't have people's conscience pricked to the point and say, well, maybe we ought to look at ourselves. Anyway, what are we doing what are we not doing that we could do to make things better, just in case? And let me hasten to say this. I know we got a time. There was a forum in Kansas City at the old Jewish Community Center about 82nd and home, where the mayor, McDowell of Kansas City, Kansas, Ike Davis of Missouri, Carl Randolph, who was my counterpart on the Kansas side, Congress for Racial Equality, I was over here, Congress for Racial Equality, and the NAACP persons, Lee Swinton,
we're going to need to get you to the end of this story.
Anyway, what I'm saying, at that particular time, people were saying, Kansas City or Kansas City, Kansas would not have a disturbance. My comments were the same as I said in this report. The social issues have not been addressed, education has not been addressed, and you're going to have these kind of things happen with them.
And Alvin Brooks, that was a wonderful comment from you. And I want to get back to Clarence Lang, professor of African and African-American studies at KU. When you hear about this, that maybe there are things we don't deal with until there are riots, do we deal with these things after they are calm? Or is a failure to do that part of why they resurface?
I think the question becomes, what is the level of organization that exists and that is augmented and after these things subside? So that's, for me, in a lot of ways, is the question that's foremost on my mind as I look at what's unfolding on the TV screen. What kinds of organizations will exist after this to address the ongoing issues that led up to this in the first place? I mean, there are churches, but there may be new organizations that create, or there may be existing organizations that will have to be changed. And so I guess that's, for me, that there has to be something in place after the press has left, after things have subsided, to continue to work on these longstanding issues.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's show, looking back at this history of racially charged protests, riots, upheavals in the Midwest. Rusty Mulholland, Clarence Lang, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And an extra thanks to the studios of Kansas Public Radio for the connection to Professor Lang, as well as our other guests and callers who joined us this hour. It was a great conversation. To continue the conversation, take part in this week's Tell KCUR. Our question of the week is, what can Kansas City learn from Ferguson? In the next hour, Up to Date, we'll explore the mindset of law enforcement during conflicts like the one in Ferguson, so stay tuned for that. You can listen back to today's conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard, and you can sign up for our podcast while you're there. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, signing out for today. Stick around for Up to Date, coming up next.
This is KCUR FM, KCUR HD1, Kansas City Public Media.